the podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment when the world was nearly destroyed in late October 1962. You can follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened 50 years ago. It was our closest brush to nuclear Armageddon. The Cuban Missile Crisis is normally talked about as 13 days, 13 very perilous days in October 1962, from October 16th to October 28th.
Parenthetically, if I may interrupt at this point just for a moment, there was a movie made in 2000 by Kevin Costner and others called 13 Days, and while the movie is pretty scary, what Janet's about to tell you is worth listening to.
Basically, if you buy into the 13 days account, then the question arises, well, so the missile crisis started on October 16th, in 1962. No, actually, we're going to take a little more radical view, and we're going to make an argument to you now that the missile crisis began in April of 1961. So I'm going to ask Jim to just sort of paint the picture of what happened in April of 1961.
So instead of 13 days, we're talking about 18 months. A little different story. April 17th, 1961, on that date, a group of about 1,200 Cuban exiles, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, who'd been training in Guatemala under the CIA, were outfitted by the CIA and transported by the CIA and trained in every way by the CIA, landed at a beach on the south coast of Cuba called the Bay of Pigs. The inlet's called the Bay of Pigs, which is the surrounding area. Now, in April of 1961, John Kennedy had been in office for 3 months. Within 72 hours of the landing at the Bay of Pigs, the invaders were defeated by the Castro forces, about 200,000 of them. There was no uprising on the island. There was really nothing much going on the island except the exiles were rounded up, put in trucks, and taken to Havana for trial, a public trial. Now, back in Washington, this was startling to say the least. Kennedy was completely humiliated. It became obvious right from the beginning that the CIA was behind this. Well, this, and Kennedy had let it go forward. He tried to limit it. The plan had begun under Eisenhower, so he didn't feel really comfortable kind of shutting it down because Eisenhower was a popular president. Eisenhower was a military leader before he became president. And so it was a bit iffy as to this young 43-year-old beautiful man with a beautiful family from Harvard telling all these military and intelligence people to shut something down that Eisenhower had started. So he didn't quite. Well, he wound up with almost the worst of all worlds here. He wound up being humiliated. He also wound up being reviled by a lot of the allies in Europe for even trying this in the first place. I mean, it was just ridiculous to invade another country. Why? Why? Cuba is a threat, as was said in France and Germany and Britain. Cuba's a threat to the United States? We don't think so. Keep your eye on the ball, Kennedy. And that meant keep your eye on Europe. Kennedy's take on this is that I don't want this to happen anymore. I made a mistake, and I'm not going to make this mistake again if I can help it at all. But Khrushchev, yes, Janet.
Khrushchev certainly has a different take on this. Kennedy, yes, sees it as a defeat, and he wants to get past it as soon as he can. Khrushchev, now let's sort of say a little bit about him and about his relationship to Castro. About 3 months or so, maybe 4 months actually, before the Bay of Pigs invasion, Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro met for the first time in New York City. They actually met in Harlem at the Teresa Hotel.
It was love at first sight. Sorry.
No, exactly. And actually, the two of them together, so here you've got two generations of revolutionaries. And so you have this meeting of the minds in terms of revolution, in terms of communism, in terms of socialism, and they actually had an embrace.
And a meeting of the bodies as well as the minds. The very short and extremely wide Nikita Khrushchev, in a not terribly well-fitting suit, came up to Fidel's, past his belt, but not nearly up to his shoulders. Fidel hunches over, bearded, cigar in the left hand. He looks like he's about to plant a big kiss on the bald head of Nikita Khrushchev. I can't say for sure whether he did or whether he didn't. I wasn't there. But that photo became instantly famous or infamous, depending on your point of view. Here was a Latin American. Latin America in those days was considered to be America's playground, especially Cuba. It was where people went to gamble and get drunk and get sunburned. And Castro, the feeling was, Castro has taken this away from us. He's turned into a communist. And our arch enemy Khrushchev is now trying to get his little fat paws around this big Cuban. And the Cuban is embracing him right in New York City.
So this is deep in the Cold War. And what you have then is this combination of socialism and communism, a meeting of the minds and the bodies, the big country, the small country, the Soviet Union, and Cuba. Okay, it's within this context then that Khrushchev is then observing and getting reports of the events of April 1961, the invasion at the Bay of Pigs. And what happens, in a sense, to almost add insult to injury, is that the day of the invasion, April 17th, is Nikita Khrushchev's 66th birthday. And he receives this information, and I guess the best way to describe it is he blows a gasket. He just is outraged that Kennedy would do this. And so he immediately writes a letter to Kennedy. And it's a very, very interesting letter. It's included as letter number 4 in our book, The Armageddon Letters. And the tone of it is a break from the previous letters that he's been writing to Kennedy. They had been congratulatory letters. I'm glad you won the election. I actually prefer to work with you rather than Richard Nixon. Let's work together. I know we have disagreements, but let's work together for world peace, blah, blah, blah. Well, not this letter. This letter is dated April 18th, 1961, and I want to read just two or three short passages from there, the letter, to give you a real flavor of what Nikita Khrushchev is trying to convey to John Kennedy. John Kennedy, who already is in just the worst position he's ever been in since being president. So here's the letter. Dear Mr. President, I send you this message in an hour of alarm, fraught with danger for the peace of the whole world. Armed aggression has begun against Cuba, and it is a secret to no one that the armed bands invading this country were trained, equipped, and armed in the United States of America. So there, John Kennedy, he says.
I think this was particularly insulting to Khrushchev because Kennedy had made a bunch of statements earlier in the year, January, February, March, now it's April, to the effect that the U.S. will not invade Cuba and that we have no intention of invading Cuba. What he says later that he meant by that was that no regular U.S. forces would invade Cuba, but of course, if you're in Cuba and a brigade lands on your shore with the object of overthrowing your government, it doesn't really make much difference what language they speak or where they came from, because the whole thing was made possible by the good old CIA.
And so Khrushchev then continues in his letters, and he writes to Kennedy, quote, I approach you, Mr. Kennedy, with an urgent call to put an end to the aggression against the Republic of Cuba. Military armament and the world political situation are such at this time that any so-called little war can touch off a chain reaction in all parts of the globe, unquote.
Now, this is scary. This is apparently saying, and I think we know pretty sure that this was Kennedy's feeling. This is Kennedy's reading of it. You mess around with Cuba, Kennedy, and you're taking the risk of going to war, not just with Cuba. We know that you can pulverize Cuba if you want to, but we can pulverize Berlin. West Berlin is 80 miles inside of East Germany. We have 3 million troops. You've got 12,000. We can make you toast within 10 minutes. So watch out. If you go into Cuba, there will be retaliation. And we know what happens in the nuclear age if two nuclear powers were to go at it toe-to-toe directly. There's a very good chance that we would blow up the world. So, Mr. President, you go into Cuba next time, you might have just hit the button on the doomsday machine.
But remember, Khrushchev is so angry here, he's not going to take any chances that Kennedy misses his point.
Right.
Maybe he infers that, maybe he doesn't. But he ends his letter by saying, quote, "We will render the Cuban people and their government all necessary help to repel armed attack in Cuba." It's not an ambiguous statement.
No, and he's not kidding, because we now know that virtually simultaneous with the sending of this letter, he put through the order to send the Cubans what we think they need. They need tanks, they need MiG fighter aircraft, they need lots of bullets, they need bombs, they need guns, they need uniforms, they need training. All of it given free of charge to Cuba, much of it not even requested, because the Cubans were new at this. They didn't expect the Soviet leader to, in effect, adopt them.
So it seems to us pretty clear that really the smoking gun for the Cuban Missile Crisis is the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961. This is where it began. But what's really interesting is that while we can now look at all of the historical evidence, we can look back, we can make these connections, the key thing to remember is that in 1961, nobody going forward in time, not Kennedy, not Khrushchev, not Castro, is thinking that this could possibly lead to the Cuban Missile Crisis. The connection that we draw between the Bay of Pigs invasion and the Cuban Missile Crisis is one of the most amazing unintended consequences in all of history, I think.
Yeah, you know, Janet, one of the odd things that happens, and one of the reasons that the Bay of Pigs has been sort of shunted aside when it comes to talking about the missiles, or one thing is it's all about the missiles. Well, yeah, the missiles come almost like the frosting on top of the cake at the very end after the cake is already mixed and baked. Because the Cuba issue in the Kennedy-Khrushchev correspondence and conversation just essentially goes underground. So they get, very shortly, they start arguing about Berlin, West Berlin. We know later in the year, Khrushchev will order put up a wall in Berlin to keep the East Germans from escaping to the West, among other things. And then there's Laos, and then there's Vietnam. There's all of these issues, and it's as if Cuba is this kind of repressed thing. It's there. It's being followed by U.S. intelligence. All of this stuff, this hardware and all this, these gadgets and all these uniforms, Cuba is becoming militarized, and it's all compliments of the Soviet Union, and people in the intelligence community are telling Kennedy, whoa, whoa. But it's not a top-drawer issue yet.
Maybe we could use the phrase, it's sort of a smoldering crisis. So it's there. It's heating up. Now, this is the Cold War. But what's interesting is that with this smoldering crisis that begins really with the Bay of Pigs, the heat's on. And eventually that temperature is going to rise and rise very high in the missile crisis. And it's the potential there to go from the Cold War to a very hot war.
Yeah, and we know also that Khrushchev wasn't completely irrational here in thinking that he had to move fast to save Cuba. Now, Kennedy in his own mind probably, as we think now, probably thought, geez, another invasion of Cuba. Are you kidding me after this? He didn't want it. But that doesn't mean that a lot of people in the government didn't want it. And as a matter of fact, all through 1961, all through 1962, up to the missile crisis in October, all through that period, American troops, fighting men, boats, planes, they start moving toward the island of Cuba, just in case. There might be a contingency under which Kennedy might want to go to war. But there's something else going on. It's called Operation Mongoose. That comes late in 1961, later in 1961, in the fall. And this is a program of covert operations to send the exiles secretly, clandestinely into Cuba to blow up buses, blow up roads, department stores, torch, sugarcane fields, all kinds of really nasty stuff that we now call terrorism. All that's going on inside Cuba, and the American forces are beginning to sort of move a little closer toward the island. There's more of them. Soviet intelligence picks this up. Cuban intelligence picks this up. But Kennedy himself is not really concerned about Cuba. He thinks Cuba is a second-tier issue, and he, with some reason, and he wanted to focus on nuclear disarmament. He wanted to focus on Berlin, because those were the biggies. So Castro and Khrushchev are rational in that they see the threat building, but they don't know that Kennedy doesn't want to use it. Kennedy is off on other things, worrying about other foreign policy issues, and really doesn't give Cuba any thought to speak of until virtually the Cuban Missile Crisis.
But he allows all these other activities to go on, which certainly then plays into the concern, the fear of Khrushchev and Castro that the U.S. really wants to destroy Cuba.
Right. So. And there's also the view that when Kennedy and Khrushchev actually met for 2 days in early June in 1961, that the feeling was, I think, in the Kennedy and his people that Khrushchev really bullied him and kind of beat up on him. I don't think Khrushchev felt that he did, but Kennedy felt that it would be a good idea to show strength wherever you could, but not because you want to go to war, just because you have to show some movement along with your intentions, and that's how the Cold War can move along in a cold way rather than breaking out into a hot war. So, end of this part of the story. Castro and Khrushchev feel that Cuba is threatened and the threat is increasing. Kennedy's eye is not on that ball. He's into other things. The Cuba issue in Washington goes underground and it explodes as if it came out of nowhere in October of 1962. And that's primarily why most people think it did happen, all of it, in October 1962, the famous 13 days, because they only know the American side of the story. But the Russian side and the Cuban side of the story involves the previous 18 months as well as the famous 13 days. So that's it for this podcast. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series as well as news about our new book, the short films, the graphic novels, blogs by our three leaders. And don't forget to visit us, please, at facebook.com/Armageddon Letters. I'm Jim Blake.
And I'm Janet Lang. Thanks a lot for climbing aboard our virtual time machine to discover what it was like when the world hung by a thread.